Thank you, Father. Thank you. We cannot speak about Amoris Laetitia without a jubilee, jubilus, because it is certainly the most joyful thing, the joy of love. The joy of love. And it's about the joy of love that this document is speaking. So I have three previous methodological remarks. I apologize if I'm a little bit tired, I admit, because the last days were very, very dense, but very joyful. And first of all, I must express my deep joy and gratitude for this document. I have read it, I have read it with great and growing joy. That means it's worthy to be read, to be discussed after having been read would be quite useful, to have read the document before discussing it. Second previous remark, Pope Francis told us at the beginning of the Synod, I see one participant of the Synod among us, of the first Synod, we were together in the same language group, parlate con paresia e ascoltate con umiltà. He has repeated several times as an invitation, speak with frankness, with paresia. Yeah. And he said, I was sad when I heard from a cardinal that he didn't express what he had in his heart and mind because he thought it may offend the Holy Father. No. Frankness, paresia, is a mark of Christian attitude. And therefore it is important among Christians, but especially in an academic institution, a Catholic academic institution, discussion is essential. It should be based on arguments, not only on emotions. Emotions are very important, we will see in the document, but it is so important. There is no forbidden question. There are sometimes stupid answers, but normally there are no stupid questions. So this document is a magisterial document, but it is not an encyclical, it's an exhortation. That's another magisterial level. It's not an encyclical, it's not a motu proprio, it's not a canonical writing, it's an exhortation. An apostolic exhortation, it's an exhortation of our Holy Father, and that means that we have to listen to it with what the dogmatic language calls religious cum affecto religioso, with religious readiness to submission, but not a refusal to discuss. And I think Pope Francis would be the last one to want us not to discuss what he proposes. And he is here well in the line of Pope Benedict, who as a professor, as a bishop, and then as the Holy Father, as the Pope, always insisted that we need this frank discussion, because we are all in search of truth and on the way of truth, and therefore we need also to illuminate each other with our view and our thoughts. And the third point is, the third previous point is, I would suggest that you, that we all read this text, putting into brackets the note 351. It's the only place where the question of the sacraments is addressed for those in irregular situations. It's a very short note. But it tends to become the question of the synods and the questions of this apostolic exhortation. Pope Francis said to me in an audience when we spoke about the coming synod, between the two synods, he said to me, "It's una trappola. It's a trap. It's a trap because we focus on one point and forget to see the whole picture." So, methodologically, I invite you to put this little footnote into brackets. It's only a footnote. And to see the document, to look and to listen to the document, to, so to say, the great vision, the great arch he is building in this apostolic exhortation. I had the privilege yesterday to present the document together with Cardinal Baldisseri and a couple. There was an enormous interest. I had given at least 20 interviews after this public presentation. Great interest throughout the world. But the interest very often is focused on note 351. Can they or can they not? Point, point, point. Yeah. As if this were the only question. Yeah. Anyhow, it's very difficult to overcome this narrowness, this trapola, this trap, and to open our mind and our heart to this document. I think, as a Grand Chancellor of this institute, which I love so much, which we all, I hope we all love so much, I think this has to be, at least till the next apostolic exhortation on marriage and family in some years, this has to be a part of the curriculum. It's evident. As Familiaris Consortio is part of the curriculum, as Humanae Vitae is part of the curriculum, because it's part of the ongoing teaching of the Church on marriage and family. And I think an institute that's mainly devoted to the study of marriage and family, of course, must be open and interested and seriously interested into the Magisterium of the Holy Father. Now, I'll try to give you some of my impressions. Of course, the text is long. Yeah, it's an apostolic exhortation of Latin American dimensions. We were used to Polish dimensions in Poland is large, and but Latin America is larger. But Pope Francis, in the beginning, there are some humorous aspects in his writing. He knows that the text is long. Perciò non consiglio, I haven't got the English text yet, I have it on my iPad, but you were at a press conference yesterday, yes. I'm happy to see alumni of ITI being at the press conference yesterday. I can translate freely. Yeah. I do not give you the advice to have a rapid reading. I rather recommend, says Pope Francis, to read chapter by chapter. And I urge you to start with chapter 4. Astonishingly, everybody rushes to chapter 8, where the question is the crisis of marriage and family. They have not heard the lecture of for Professor Harstetter. Focus only on the problems. Pope Francis, from the very beginning, invites us to focus on the good of marriage. It's the whole encyclical, the whole apostolic exhortation is a great jubilus on the beauty and the richness of marriage and family. But of course, if you have a narrow focus only on one question, then you will miss the rest. So I urge you to read specially chapter 4, which is a great comment on chapter 13 of the first letter to the Corinthians. Detailed comment, word by word, of this great hymn applied to the life of marriage and family. And it's so tasty, it's so rich, so close to life, and so encouraging. After having heard your talk, where is Michaela? Here she is, yeah. I must say it was a perfect introduction to the document. As what you said about graduality is exactly what is the great line of step by step leading into the deepness, into the depth, into the full reality of marriage and family, of the sacramental life. And what you said about motivation. Pope Francis tries to show that we should not be discouraged by the failures, the many difficulties, to be motivated for the sacrament of marriage. And motivation needs attraction from the good. As I will show, I think the whole document has a very Thomistic Grundlinie, red thread, yeah? Because the key of the document is that we can only be motivated for trusting love, marital love, and marriage and family, if we are motivated, if we believe, if we deeply believe that it is possible and that it is good. But nevertheless, I want to start with, after this introduction, start with a point which may not receive the full agreement of all of you, and I'm not afraid about that because we can discuss it. It's not a secret I come from a so-called broken family, patchwork family. we have received now a seminarian in the diocese, very nice young man, good, talented young man. He's a typical situation of many families today. My children, your children, our child. He is our child from two broken marriages. So he has half brothers of this side, half brothers of this side, and he's the one of a new marriage. Can you, sorry to say that, but I think it is important to also to understand the notes of this document, the sound of this document, or the taste. Can you understand that the church talk on marriage and family is sometimes difficult to listen to for people who have not had the chance to grow up in a solid family? And this is the case of a great, great number of young people. How does the church address them, encouraging them that marriage and love is possible? What language do we have on marriage and family? And I think this is one of the deep motivations of Pope Francis is to help people who are in irregular situations or coming from irregular situations to be attracted by, let us say, the ideal of Catholic sacramental marriage. Pope Francis overcomes somehow, and I think this is important, overcomes somehow a dichotomy between the regular and the irregular situations. Because if you come from an irregular situation, you may have the impression there are the regulars and here are the irregulars. But the gospel is different. St. Paul says that, you know, the word in Romans 11:32, God has consigned all to disobedience that he may have mercy on all. The deep line of this document is what Michaela said in her talk from Professor Ratzinger. Yeah. We are all in via. We are all in via to holiness. All. Whether our marriage is realized and happy and, so to say, in order, or whether it is not in order. We are all on the way, on the journey. Even a marriage in which everything is going well is journeying. It must grow, it must learn, it must grow even into old age. There's a beautiful passage where Pope Francis speaks about the renewal of marital love in old age. Yeah. How to learn the new dimensions of all the aspects of marital love in elder years. We are all on a way. And therefore the language of this document is inclusive, not in the sense of gender inclusiveness. It is inclusive as he explicitly said, the gospel addresses everybody. And it's an invitation to everybody. It's an invitation. And the Christian discourse on the family, the Christian vision of marriage and the family, has to become an invitation, an encouragement to the joy of love in which we can believe and in which, from which nobody is excluded. Really, nobody. So, what I would call the kind of language event of Pope Francis, already Evangelii Gaudium, and now Amoris Laetitia, is a language of deep respect and appreciation. I know some are afraid when you say, how can you address irregular situations with a language of deep respect and even appreciation. I know this language of inclusion, inclusion in the sense of addressing everybody and inviting everybody, troubles some people. It's the fear of relativism. I know it from the synod discussions, the two synod meetings, the fear of relativism. Does it lead to relativism when you address people in irregular situation with a language of respect? But I think what already Pope Francis said in Evangelii Gaudium, it is not first of all to judge the situation, to put everybody in a category. First we meet people, we meet person. And for everybody it applies what he said in Evangelii Gaudium, we must take off our shoes before the sacred ground of the other. It's the biblical image of Moses taking off his shoes for the sacred ground of God's presence. God's presence in every person. Take off the shoes before the sacred ground of the other. And this fundamental attitude runs throughout the whole exhortation. And it provides the most profound reason for the two other key words of the document, discernment and to accompany. And these words apply not only to the so-called irregular situations, but rather for all people, for every marriage. Discernment. Is a biblical term, but especially an Ignatian term. Pope Francis is really a Jesuit. I can say that as a Dominican, with deep respect, he is truly a Jesuit. In the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, the key question is to discern what is God's will in this my situation. And this openness we can observe in Pope Francis' own daily life. Yeah? This openness, this disponibility. Send me, I am ready. Disponibility for God's will now in my life, God's presence in my life. And we will see in chapter 8, famous chapter 8, how important this keyword discernment becomes for the difficult situations of marriages. It does not mean permissiveness. It does not mean relativism. It means, first of all, conversion. Another word that Michaela has used, centered in her intervention, conversion. And, of course, Pope Francis refers, how can he do otherwise, to John chapter 8, the adultery woman. He does not relativize adultery. There's no trace of relativism. Jesus only points to all of us. Who of you is without sin, he may throw the first stone. It's not said that adultery is not adultery. It is only said we all need conversion. Let me quote a longer passage to give more his original sound. It's number 36 of Amoris Laetitia, 35. As Christians, against relativism, as Christians, we can hardly stop advocating marriage simply to avoid countering contemporary sensibilities or out of desire to be fashionable or a sense of helplessness in the face of human and moral failings. We cannot renounce to present the fullness of Christian sacramental marriage. We would be depriving the world of values that we can and must offer. It is true that there is no sense in simply decrying present day's evils as if this could change things, nor is it helpful to try to impose rules by sheer authority. Not by sheer authority, by motivation. What we need is a more responsible and generous effort to present the reasons and motivations for choosing marriage and the family, and in this way to help man and woman better to respond to the grace that God offers them. I think it's exactly what Michaela said about the right understanding of graduality. I hope so. But then he adds, the Christian vision of marriage and family has an unchanged force of attraction. He deeply believes that we must not fear to present marriage and family in the Christian vision. But he adds, we also need to be humble and realistic and acknowledging that at times the way we present our Christian beliefs and treat other peoples has helped contribute to today's problematic situation. This self-critique is certainly healthy. We have also proposed a far too abstract and almost artificial theological ideal of marriage, far removed from the concrete situations and practical possibilities of families così come sono, as they are. This excessive idealization, especially when we have failed to inspire trust in God's grace, has not helped to make marriage more desirable and attractive, but quite the opposite. I think one background, we never must forget reading the apostolic exhortation is that Pope Francis has had to do a lot with poor families. With poor families. And you can feel, there I have some beautiful quotes from his, you can feel the deep respect he has for the struggling of poor people to survive, to hold their families together, to help each other. And we can see it now with the refugees. What happens with the refugees? They look where they have relations, family members. There they try to go to Sweden. I remember people at the railway station in Vienna. We want to go to Sweden. There I have a cousin. Where did my mother go with me as a baby and my elder brother 2 years old when she had to flee from at home in 1945. Where did she go? To the first place where parents were near the border. Yeah. Of course, a family. Yeah. And you can feel through the whole document this deep sense of respect for the greatness of efforts of poor people living their family life. And it is perhaps good for us living in a wealthy society to be remembered what heroism families live throughout the world and to address this with deep respect, with appreciation, with admiration. I said yesterday, I can't, Jocelyn, you hadn't been in the Second Synod. You have been in the Second Synod? No, only in the first, yeah. In the Second Synod, we had 13 language groups. Two of the language groups began their work with an interesting experiment. They exchanged... each of the members said, how is my own family situation? It's very interesting. Suddenly, these 20 people of the language group were in the midst of the reality of their own families. And what we have been discussing in the synod are these realities. So I think... our own families as they are. Pope Francis in number 37, we have long thought that simply by stressing doctrinal, bioethical and moral issues without encouraging openness to grace, we were providing sufficient support to families, strengthening the marriage bond and giving meaning to marital life. We find it difficult to present marriage more as a dynamic path to personal development and fulfillment than as a lifelong burden. We also find it hard to make room for the conscience of the faithful, who very often respond to best as they can to the gospel, admit their limitations, and are capable of carrying out their own discernment in complex situations. We have been called to form consciences, not to replace them. I know when we speak about conscience in our days, there is immediately the fear that that becomes subjectivism. But we cannot renounce to speak about conscience only because there is an abuse of the concept of conscience. Strengthening the conscience, as we are here in a place of studies, I would like to propose a passage from the chapter 5 on education. You can feel the Jesuit in this chapter. It's a beautiful, beautiful chapter on education in the family. Where is this text? Sorry. No, here it is. Ah, yeah. There are two opposite dangers in education, he says. The danger of laissez-faire, anti-authoritarian education, or the danger of excessive vigilance. And I quote this text on obsessive vigilance. Obsession, however, is not education, he says. We cannot control every situation that a child may experience. If parents are obsessed with always knowing where their children are and controlling all their movements, they will seek only to dominate space, but it is not a way to educate, strengthen, and prepare their children to face challenges. What is most important is the ability lovingly to help them grow in freedom, maturity, overall discipline, and real autonomy. I think what Pope Francis says here on education is very true for marriage and family. Pope Francis often returns to the issue of trust in the conscience of the faithful. I again quote what I have already quoted. We have been called to form consciences, not to replace them. The great question, obviously, is this: how do we form consciences? How do we arrive at what is the key concept of all this great document? The correct understanding of Pope Francis' intentions is the word personal discernment. That it may not be subjectivism, relativism, but real responsible discernment. Personal discernment. Indeed, this must help to discern the will of God in the concrete situations of life. It is discernment that grants a person a mature character, and the Christian path should be of help in reaching this personal maturity, not forming automatons, how do you say automatons? Robots. Not to form robots, extrinsically conditioned and remote controlled, but people who have matured in their friendship with Christ. And here I see a deep link between what Pope Benedict said from the very beginning of his pontificate, his first homily. Yeah. Christian life is not a catalogue of morals, but it's a living relation, a friendship with Jesus. Yeah. And if you read the chapter 9, Spirituality of Marriage, it's exactly that. That's the conclusion of the whole document, is friendship with Jesus within marital life and family. And he's very explicit that without the openness for the presence of God and the fellowship of Jesus, we cannot understand the meaning of sacramental marriage. It cannot be understood only by command, by giving discipline. Therefore, the theme of growth is so important in the whole document. the theme of growth. And I had great joy to read the passions. St. Thomas has focused very much on the passions for moral life. There is no moral life without a passionate life. In our modern world, in our puritanical world, passions have become something very negative. And in Catholic moral theology, except Professor Spindelberg, the passions have been taken out. In St. Thomas, they are essential because there is no virtuous life without passion. Passion are the motor, they motivate, they give, as Pope Francis says, I have not this quote here in mind, he says that the passions allow to reach the full depth of our personal decisions, the decision to lifelong fidelity in marriage. It's not only a decision that is taken here or only by will. It must be taken by will, but it must be go through our entire life, passionate life. And therefore, I recommend to you to read this chapter. I remember that Pope Benedict has, Cardinal Ratzinger has asked us, Dani may remember, that in the moral section of the Catechism, there is an important chapter on passions. You remember. Yeah.
Because a certain part of the Catechism is not Christian morals.
Yeah.
Life in Christ and life in the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Frau Professor has said, explicitly, it's not the moral part. The third part of the Catechism is life in Christ. Yeah. And to see marital life under this aspect is, of course, a great change. So I come to the last point, of course, we must speak about the number 300 in chapter 8, and a little footnote, because it would be unhonest to leave it out. Even if it is a trappler, a trap, to focus only on this question. Number 300 deals with the question, the le circostanze attenuanti, how do you say in English? What a good idea to have an English text here. Attenuating circumstances. Attenuating circumstances. Yeah, exactly. What is possible? To make it clear, I apologize. I'm a little bit tired and not so a little bit confused. But I hope we'll come to a good end. attenuating circumstances. Thank you, Dani. Are we here off the record? Not really. I was so happy when I read the document that very clearly Pope Francis said, if we consider the immense variety of concrete situations, such as those that I have mentioned, irregular situation, it is understandable that neither the Synod nor this exhortation would be expected to provide a new set of general rules, canonical in nature and applicable to all cases. It's really a little bit off the record, but it's important. Since 93, when the three German bishops have published their pastoral letter on the divorce and remarried situation, Professor Spindelberg knows the text very well. CDF, the Congregation of Doctrine of Faith, has responded with this famous document on the impossibility of sacramental access for divorced remarried. The key mistake, in my understanding, was of these three German bishops that they aimed to a canonical universal regulation for these situations. And I was so happy when Pope Francis clearly said, this is not possible. For the very precise reason that a marriage is a marriage is a marriage. Yeah. And there is no question about it. Yeah. A sacramentally valid marriage is a sacramentally valid marriage. And you cannot find a kind of general canonical exception, canonical rule that rules these very diverse situations. Yeah. What is the solution? Pope Francis adds, what is possible is simply a renewed encouragement to undertake a responsible personal and pastoral discernment of particular cases on which one which would recognize that, yeah, of course, that's the main answer. A personal and pastoral discernment of particular cases. Now, of course, I know the alarm bells are ringing around this word. But first of all, please be sure, the important affirmation is there is no canonical, new canonical disposition possible to regulate the cases for divorced remarried people or other irregular situations. And I'm very happy that this is clearly stated. Yeah. What is... what is possible is simply a renewed encouragement to undertake a responsible personal and pastoral discernment of particular cases. What does this mean? I invite you, as we did in the Synod of last year, to join Familiaris Consortio. I urge you to study this in this institute. Yeah? I am personally convinced that there is a deep continuity between Pope Francis and St. John Paul II, between Familiaris Consortio, the understanding of graduality in Familiaris Consortio, as Michaela has shown, and as he treats the graduality passo per passo, step by step, approaching and fulfilling the full reality of sacramental marriage. And the number 84, famous number 84 of Familiaris Consortio, where St. John Paul speaks about the situation of new unions and their place in the church. Of course, Pope Francis insists very much on their inclusion into the life of the church, but he does not innovate compared to John Paul II. And I read what John Paul II said in Familiaris Consortio. Pastors must know that for the sake of truth, for the sake of truth, they are obliged to exercise careful discernment of situations. What does that mean? To exercise this discernment of careful discernment by the love of truth. Yeah, they are obliged. It's not just at your pleasure. It's an obligation for the shepherd to discern. And he gives three examples. There is in fact a difference between those who have sincerely tried to save their first marriage and have been unjustly abandoned. I take the case of my mother. Yeah, she was left with four children. She had to bring up four children, working. If she had remarried, she never did, and she consciously remained faithful to her sacramental marriage. But if she had found a partner who would have been ready to assume the education of four children, it's morally another situation than the second case Pope John Paul enumerates. The second case is someone who, through his own grave fault, has destroyed a canonical valid marriage. Forget the question of communion. It's only the question of discernment, of moral situation. Somebody who has remarried. I had the case in a parish recently, some years ago. The head of the parish council married with four children, abandons his wife, comes with a young lady, married civilly, and he was very angry with me when I said, you cannot continue to be head of the parish council. And he wanted to go to communion. I said, no. I mean, that's another situation that if somebody who has wanted to stay faithful, but out of poverty, out of misery or whatever, assumes a second marriage. The point here is only to come to a different moral valuation. Beside the question of the sacraments. And he gives a third case, Pope John Paul, gives a third case. Finally, there are those who have entered into a second union for the sake of the children's upbringing. That's something similar to the first case. And who are sometimes subjectively certain in conscience, their personal conscience, that their previous and irreparably destroyed marriage had never been valid. I know cases like that. They were morally certain that the first marriage was invalid, but for concrete reasons it was not possible to come to an annulment. Our common cousin, Janka, was in this situation. Yeah. We were absolutely certain that her husband's first marriage was invalid, but it was impossible to get annulment. Yeah. So the moral situation of these three cases has to be considered. The pastors, for the sake of truth, are obliged to exercise careful discernment of situations. This had nothing to do with relativism. This is pastoral duty of everybody of us. And this is the same for lay people. You have to discern morally situations. Yeah? Yeah? Moral discernment is an essential part of a human and Christian life. Yeah? Everybody has to discern. And the shepherd, the pastor, has a special responsibility to discern, not alone, but together with the concerned people. I come to an end there, sorry. And then Pope John Paul adds, together with the synod, I earnestly call upon pastors and the whole community of the faithful to help the divorced and with solicitous care to make sure that they do not consider themselves as separated from the church. Some people were afraid because Pope Francis said this in his writing, but it's exactly the same as John Paul II. They should not consider themselves as separated from the church, for as baptized persons, they can and indeed must share in her life, in the church's life. They must share in her life. They should be encouraged to listen to the word of God, to attend the sacrifice of the Mass, to persevere in prayer, to contribute to works of charity and to community efforts in favor of justice, to bring up their children in the Christian faith, to cultivate the spirit and practice of penance, and thus implore day by day God's grace. Now, put this in relation to what Pope Francis says, that we cannot say in every case of irregular situation that they live in mortal sin. It is exactly what Pope John Paul said. You cannot do all this if you live in mortal sin. It's a difficult discernment. He adds, let the church pray for them, encourage them, and show herself a merciful mother, and thus sustain them in faith and hope. I think we have a lot of work to do in this institute to go over again and again over these documents, the Church's Magisterium, and to see what it really means. What it really means to deal with these many situations we have in our own families, in our own communities. I remember what Pope Francis does. Pope Benedict had already said, asked about these situations. There are no easy recipes. And Pope Francis says, it's not black and white. There are situations that are black, yes, and he's very explicit. There are situations where you have clearly to say, this is an absolute no-go. He's very explicit about so-called gay marriage. Very explicit. It has been reported in the media as a negatively reported in the media, that he's very clear and explicit about that. There are clear no-goes. Yeah? But there are many situations where, in the line of what St. John Paul already said in Familiaris Consortia, the integration of people in irregular situations is a pastoral duty, because they are baptized and they are called to live as they can in the limits of what they can, their life of faith. And now at the very end, the question of this little footnote. I show you the text in English. It's 300. Yeah, 305, where Pope Francis says, because of forms of conditioning and mitigating factors, it is possible that in an objective situation of sin, which may not be subjectively culpable or fully such, a person can be living in God's grace, can love and can also grow in the life of grace and charity while receiving the church's help to this end. And here he has in the footnote only this little word: in certain cases, this can include the help of the sacraments. The help of the sacraments. Yeah. What does he mean with that? Why isn't he more explicit about it? Why has he put it into the footnote? I was asked yesterday by many journalists, there was one of the key questions, why a footnote about such an important question? Yeah. Why only a footnote? Is it to hide? Is it to prevent critique from those who are possibly nervous about such words? I don't know. I haven't asked him why he has placed it in a footnote. There is one point very clear. Already Pope John Paul II has known in certain cases explicitly. And this is important for the understanding that I read you the text if I find him again. Sorry. I'm an old professor lost in my papers. Where is it? Sorry. Has somebody stolen my paper? The paper of Pope John. John Paul? Here it is. Sorry. You all know the famous exception Pope John Paul has explicitly said. However, the Church reaffirms her practice, which is based upon sacred scripture, of not admitting to Eucharistic communion divorced persons who have remarried. They are unable to be admitted thereto from the fact that their state and condition is objectively contradict that union of love between Christ and the Church, which is signified and effected by the Eucharist. Besides this, there's another special pastoral reason. If these people were admitted to Eucharist, the faithful would be led into error and confusion regarding the Church's teaching about the indissolubility of marriage. It's very clear. But then he says, this means in practice that when, for serious reasons, such as, for example, the children's upbringing, a man and a woman can satisfy the obligation to separate, they take on themselves the duty, to live in complete continence, that is, by abstinence from the acts proper to marriage couple, then they can practice the sacraments. Of course, being careful not to be to give scandal. But Pope Francis has a little note on that where he seems to observe that nonetheless they live a marital life, not with sexual union, but they live together, they share their life, and publicly they are a couple. Yeah. So I think that careful discernment requires from the pastors and from the people concerned a very delicate conscience. We all know, probably not in better countries than in Austria, that many of our priests admit divorced remarried people to the sacraments, yeah, without asking or without discussing. That's a fact. Yeah. And it's difficult to handle for the bishop. Yeah. What I tried to do for Vienna, and I'm very happy that the synod has taken up what we have discussed in the German circle, and the Holy Father has taken up in his document in the number 300, is something different. We call it the way of the five attentions. I do not discuss the question of the sacramental communion or the access to the sacraments, but a pastoral way to follow divorced, remarried people and to see with them how they live, what Pope John Paul has said, how they can be integrated into the church's life. And I just summarize rapidly the five attentions. The first question is not whether you can go to communion. The first question is, how did you treat your children? You have separated the parents, but the children are both your children. And the question we urge to ask the people in this situation is, did you burden your children with your marital conflict? Did you make your children a hostage of your conflict, damaging them for their whole life? I always say, when we are told the church is so merciless with the divorced, remarried, then I ask, have you been merciful with your children? That's the first attention. The second attention is, how is the situation of the abandoned spouse? Our great cities are full of widows of divorces. Some remarry, but many others remain alone, isolated, in difficult situations. Before speaking about the mercy of sacraments, we should speak about the mercy to the abandoned spouse. Yeah? men or women, both. Abandoned man. Ask our clochards, how do you say, the street people, our street men, yeah, about their situation. It's always the same story. Divorce, abandoning the apartment, and they end in the street, yeah, with alcohol. Third attention is, how did you deal with the hatred and the conflict in your marriage? The hatred. Yeah. Did you enter a new marriage, a new union, yeah, with the whole burden of your hatred, of the unresolved, unreconciled situation of your previous, your sacramental marriage? Yeah. Has there been any attempt of your part and of both parts at least to reconcile, to not to live in hatred? Yeah. The fourth attention is the question, what example did you give to the church, to the society? Pope Francis speaks a lot about the damages of divorce. Read these passages. The grave social, human, economic damages of divorce. Yeah. And the fifth attention is, how is your situation in conscience with God? You cannot betray God. You can make fuss around with other people, but with God you cannot cheat. How is your situation in conscience? Yeah. And it may be the situation Pope John Paul II addresses, that in conscience you are convinced that the first marriage was not valid. But what is your situation when you are conscious, in conscience, that you have broken a valid marriage? And I think, with the attention to these five attentions, the question of the sacraments comes into another light. Yeah. It's not a reward, because it is a serious exam of your own past, your own life. It is the way of conversion, of which Michaela spoke before. Yeah. It's the way of conversion. So, sorry, I've been awfully long, but I urge the ITI to study this document, to discuss it, and there will be a big theological discussion, yeah? And it's good, it's necessary, and helpful, hopefully. Thank you.